This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين أما بعد. So I'm sure all of us are very excited for today's lecture. I'm not going to stand between you and our expert except by setting it up inshallah ta'ala, this issue of slavery and Islam. And the reason why this topic is so difficult for us to discuss, well, there are many reasons, but we as Muslims are primarily interested in how can we understand the fact that Islam maybe to potentially has allowed something that we are taught is so immoral. When Islam came, it abolished so many things. It abolished drinking alcohol. It eradicated, or at least it wanted to eradicate racism. And alcohol and racism were rampant across the globe. Our young men and women say, why didn't Islam come and eradicate slavery as well? That's a theological question. Why not? And on the flip side, we have those that want to reinterpret Islam completely when it comes to gender and sexuality and morality. And they say, look, you guys, you ultra-conservative folks, you're not advocating slavery anymore. So if we can get rid of slavery, why can't we get rid of gender and gender roles? If you guys are willing to abandon one aspect that was once upon a time a part of Islam, then why can't we also abandon another aspect? So we are stuck between a rock and a hard place. We are stuck between those groups that are saying, how could Islam have allowed it? How could Islam have allowed something that is so intrinsically evil? And they either reject Islam or our young men and women are doubting Islam. And on the other side, we have those that are saying, oh yeah, that's the whole point. Islam can evolve over time. Just like Islam evolved with slavery, so too they say to us, it should also evolve with same sex and with this and with that. Why can't we do that as well? And so that's why this topic is one that really does require so much talk and discussion. And I'm very, very honored and pleased to have with us today Dr. Jonathan Brown. Dr. Jonathan Brown is the Prince Walid ibn Talal Chair of Islamic Civilization in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Dr. Brown received his BA in history from Georgetown in 2000. By the way, he converted to Islam in the late 90s. It's on a personal, that's not on the official bio, but I'll tell you, he converted to Islam in high school and
Second year of university,
he converted to Islam second year of university. Okay, so he's not sabiqun al-awwalun, he's sabiqun al-thaniyun, what is he? The second batch of converts, but pre-9/11, which is a very important point and milestone. He finished his BA from Georgetown in 2000, and then his PhD from University of Chicago in 2006. And Dr. Brown has studied and conducted research in countries such as Egypt, Syria, Turkey, Morocco, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, South Africa, India, Indonesia, Iran, all of these countries. His book publications include The Canonization of Bukhari and Muslim, Hadith, Muhammad's Legacy in the Medieval and Modern World, Muhammad, A Very Short Introduction, which was selected for the National Endowment for the Humanities, Bridging Cultures, Muslim Journeys bookshelf. His book, Misquoting Muhammad, The Challenges and Choices of Interpreting the Prophet's Legacy, and it goes on and on and on. He has published extensively in the fields of hadith, which is what he is primarily known for in the academic world, Islamic law, Salafism, Sufism, Arabic lexical theory, and pre-Islamic poetry. What have you not published on? And he is the editor-in-chief of the Oxford Encyclopedia of Islam and Islamic Law. Dr. Brown's current research interests include Islamic legal reform and a translation of Sahih al-Bukhari. He is also the director of research at the Yaqeen Institute, and I'm also very honored to say he is a very near and dear friend for a very long time, alhamdulillah. So when I invited him to come to East Plano, he immediately jumped and agreed, even though it was just a month's notice or so. So alhamdulillah, he is here. So without further ado, should I tell you why they wrote the book, or are you going to tell them why you wrote the book?
Yeah, I'll tell them.
Okay. Without further ado, Dr. Jonathan Brown.
Okay, Bismillah. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Inna alhamdulillahi wa bihi nasta'in wa salatu wa salam ala sayyid al-mursalin wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. This topic, well, actually all the topics I write about are personal topics in the sense that I pick them because I have questions. And I remember very clearly when I had this question, because it was just after I became Muslim. It would have been probably in the fall of 1997. And I remember I was sitting in my old house, in my family's house, in my old room, and I was reading a translation of the Quran. And I came across the verse. Obviously, I was reading translation, right? But the verse said, "Daraba Allahu mathalan 'abdan mamlukan la yaqdiru 'ala shay'in wa man razaqnahu minna rizqan hasana," right? So God, the God gives you a parable of a slave who's owned and can't do anything, as opposed to someone who, you know, we presume a free person, whom we have given a goodly sustenance, and he spends out of that in secret and in private. And this actually is not making any law about slavery. It's using this as a parable for talking about idols that have no power versus God that has all power. But I remember being confused because I was thinking to myself, you know, how can God talk about slavery just kind of randomly and not say slavery is wrong? Because slavery is wrong. How can you just talk about it like that and treat it like it's no big deal? And, you know, I think maybe a lot of us read these verses in the Quran, maybe especially younger people read these verses in the Quran and don't really know what to make of them, and we kind of just kind of pass over them and then assume that there's some answer. But I think it causes a lot of doubt. And so when I decided to write this book was after the ISIS thing happened, because that was really, it was 2015, it really caused a crisis for a lot of young Muslims, because they saw you know, these people who said they were doing exactly what the Sharia, they were saying they were doing exactly what the Quran and the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam had done in taking slaves. And so a lot of young Muslims were sitting there saying, wait a second, you know, not only does my scripture talk about slavery, but now people who say they're following that scripture and who can point clearly to verses in the Quran and the Sunnah are doing so in the name of Islam. And it was really caused a lot of people to leave Islam, a lot of people to have doubts, and a lot of anxiety. So that's why I wrote this book, which is here. Yasser has it. Sheikh Yasser, sorry. And Yasser's fine. So I also forgot to thank you for inviting me, and thank you all for coming. It's a really big honor, and I hope this will be useful for you. I'm going to talk about a huge amount of material, so I'm going to go, if you're used to books of fiqh, this is a dalil-free book. This is not book with adilla, this is a book that's mukhtasar, because I'm going to go through a lot of material. So I want you to turn your brains on high power, right? I'm going to rely on high power, Texan high power brain functioning. Yes, yes, that's a thing. Let's do that. Let's go with that, okay? Texas high power brain functioning. All right. So there's, when I remember, when we read these verses of the Quran, there's two issues, right? One is, this sort of like, how can God just mention slavery and not say slavery is wrong or you shouldn't have slaves? And the second thing, which is a sort of a compound problem, is how do we explain our sense of discomfort? So if we believe that the Quran is the word of God and we believe that the Sunnah of the Prophet ﷺ is inspired by God and the Prophet is incapable of moral error, how do we also explain the fact that deep in our guts, we feel that slavery is wrong? I mean, how can the Quran be allowing something, and in our guts we feel that it's so wrong we can't conceive of it being allowed? How do we even conceptualize that? Just the existence of that feeling becomes a problem. So these are the two things I want to talk about today. One, sort of, how do we make sense of the moral problem of slavery? And then how do we make sense of our moral reaction to it? And these are really these are problems of what's called moral ontology. Now, that's the only really big word I'm going to use in this lecture, I think. a moral ontology. Well, ontology is a study of existence. And so moral ontology is really talking about what is morality? Where does it come from? What is the matter of morality? What is it made of? What does it weigh? What kinds of morality are there? We all know slavery is wrong, right? I mean, if I go out and I ask random person on the street or ask one of you in the crowd just off the street, is slavery wrong? You're going to say, yes, of course it's wrong. Okay, what does that mean? If it's wrong, how come the Prophet had slaves? How come the early Muslims had slaves? I mean, did they not know it was wrong? How do we answer this question? What does it mean to be... What kind of wrong is it? What kind of wrong is it? So these are questions that I want to try and talk about today. Okay, slavery is really hard to talk about. It's really hard to talk about globally. It's extremely hard to talk about in the United States. And there's a couple of reasons for this. The first one is that in the United States, slavery is intimately and continues to be tied to the question of race. And you don't have to be very observant or have been in this country very long to know about issues of race in this country, especially between black Americans and white Americans. And this was an issue that was formed and shaped by and then also shaped slavery in the United States. Right? So talking about slavery means talking about race. And it's especially painful because the injustices and the harms caused by slavery in the United States continue to be with us in our society. So it's a live wire, not in the sense that it's, you know, it's sensitive, in the sense that it's actually a real living problem. Okay. The second reason it's very difficult to talk about is because it involves tying our brain in knots. It involves tying our brain in knots, and people don't like to do that. Causes them anxiety. I'm going to give you an example. Who remembers the Charlottesville protests in 2017, summer of 2017? Charlottesville, Virginia, University of Virginia, founded by Thomas Jefferson. Of course, there's a nice big statue of Thomas Jefferson there. Thomas Jefferson was the author of the Declaration of Independence, one of the leading thinkers of the American Revolution, a man who believed in freedom of democracy, and a man who had a lot of slaves and had children with one of his slave women, right? Those children were then also slaves. He eventually freed them, but they were also slaves. So what? There were a lot of protesters at the University of Virginia saying slavery is an evil. It's history's greatest crime. It's wrong no matter where you are or when. And we don't want a statue of a guy who was a slave owner and who raped a slave woman up in front of our university. That's a pretty good argument, right? I mean, that's like a pretty good logical argument. Slavery is evil. This guy did slavery. Statue's got to go. Donald Trump came out. And he summarized the situation in a way that remarkably only he could do. He said, George Washington's a slave owner. Are you going to take down statues of George Washington? Imagine taking down every statue of George Washington. Imagine renaming everything that's called Washington. It's topographically or toponymically exhausting to think about that, and it's just impossible politically in the United States to talk about this issue. Wait a second, we have a contradiction here. Slavery's evil. George Washington was a slave owner. Why do we name everything after him? So this is what I call the slavery conundrum. There's an American slavery conundrum and there's an Islamic slavery conundrum, and they're very similar to one another, but I'll give you basically the slavery conundrum. The slavery conundrum is that there are three things, there are three axioms that we have to hold in modern America and in the modern West and maybe in the modern world. There's three axioms we have to hold in our mind, but it's impossible to hold all three in your mind at the same time because they're contradictory. What are they? First, slavery is an intrinsic and gross moral evil. What does that mean, intrinsic? It means that slavery itself is evil. It's not slavery's evil because it makes you sad. It's not slavery evil because you're miserable. It's not slavery evil because it causes abusive rights. Slavery in and of itself is evil. And it's not just, you know, a little evil like me, you know, smacking Yasser on the back of the head for no reason. This is a gross evil. This is never the lesser of two evils. This is never the thing you can do because there's something you think is more harmful. It is never excusable. It is a gross and intrinsic evil across space and time. What do I mean across space and time? Was slavery wrong when Thomas Jefferson did it? Talk to me like Americans. Tell me. Give me the American answer. Was slavery wrong when Thomas Jefferson did it?
Yes.
Okay, was slavery wrong during the Roman period?
Yes.
Was slavery wrong during the Egyptian times?
Yes.
It's throughout space and time. Second, so that's the first axiom. What's the second axiom? Imagine this. Go into a, what do you guys have instead of dinner parties here? Barbecues?
Biryani parties.
Yeah, but I want something with non-Muslims.
Yeah, barbecues. Yeah.
Okay, barbecues. Imagine you go to your company barbecue, and someone asks you about slavery in Islam. And you say, yeah, there is slavery, but it wasn't that bad. How is that barbecue going to go for you? Well, I don't know, actually. Texas, I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm going to retract that comment, edit that out of the video. Half my family is from Texas, so I have love for this place. But the point is, the second axiom, all slavery is slavery. There's no... you're not allowed to make distinctions within slavery. There's no good slavery and bad slavery. There's no benevolent slavery and harmful slavery. All slavery is slavery. Okay? So that's axiom number two. Axiom number three, our past has some kind of moral or legal right over us. It has some kind of moral or legal power over us. It has some kind of moral or legal authority over us. If you're a Muslim, we know what that is, right? The Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet are our sources of guidance and morality. If God commands us to do something, if the Prophet commands us to do something, we say, سَمِعْنَا وَأَطَعْنَا. Right? What is justice? It's what God commands. What is injustice? What God forbids. If you're American, maybe it's not that dramatic, but the Constitution, the Founding Fathers, these people have authority over us. I mean, we might disagree with them, but their ideas, their writings define our political life. Right? I mean, try going into a barbecue and just say, you know, George Washington was a real piece of, you know what. See what happens. You know? It's not going to go very well. What's the problem here? These three axioms cannot be held at the same time. So I say, okay, yes, Thomas Jefferson had slaves, but it was different back then. Can't say that. Slavery is a transhistoric evil throughout space and time. Yeah, there is slavery in the Bible, but slavery in the Bible is not that, it's not like slavery in America, it's not that bad. Oh, you're saying there's some kind of slavery that's okay? So, here's the problem. There is no religious or philosophical tradition that I know of, and I've done a lot of research on this, there is no philosophical or religious tradition that I know of that did not either defend, accept, or condone slavery until the 1600s, at the very earliest 1600s. So there's nobody who's going to be okay to follow. There's no one who's going to be free of the taint of slavery from world history, essentially, before the 1600s. So we have a problem. We have two axioms. Slavery is a gross and intrinsic evil throughout space and time. All slavery is slavery. That force us to condemn everything in our past, essentially. Whether you're Americans or Muslims or Hindu or Buddhist or... That's a really big problem. So we have in our minds a knot that is something that actually cannot hold together. It can't hold together. And the second you start picking at that or talking about that, the pieces start to fall apart. People don't like to talk about it. Why does this conundrum exist? Why does this conundrum exist? It's actually a result. It's also a result and a product of abolitionist discourse. So abolitionist discourse in the United States and Britain from the late 1700s into the mid-1800s argued that all slavery was a gross and intrinsic evil that had to be gotten rid of immediately. Why did it make this argument? If you're an abolitionist and you're willing to talk about some kinds of slavery being good and some kind of slavery being bad, what is the slave owner you're arguing going to say? Oh, look, yeah, I agree with you. Slavery is evil. I mean, when it's done badly, but my slaves, come look at them. They're so happy. Look how good I take care of them, right? Or, yes, we know you slavery in maybe the Caribbean is bad or in the Americas are bad, but slavery in India, this is very different, right? This is not severe. So the second you start allowing distinctions within this concept of slavery, you lose you're essentially unable to force your opponents into accepting your position. It opens the door of negotiation. So ultimately, the abolitionist position became all slavery in and of itself, by fact of it being slavery per se, cannot be accepted. It's all intrinsically evil. The problem is, if you're a historian who wants to look at slavery in world history, what are you going to notice? You're going to notice that slavery, let's say in India, is really different from slavery in the Americas, or that slavery in Istanbul is really different from slavery in Southeast Asia. And so you're going to start actually talking about these distinctions that will start to pull the threads out of this abolitionist argument. So that's why this discussion it's not easy for us to have it, because it starts to pick at the very abolitionist consensus that is held worldwide today. Okay. The abolitionist movement, as I said, that developed in the United States and Great Britain in the late 1700s and the early 1800s, defined slavery legally. It defined it through a legal definition. What does that mean? It talked about a certain kind of relationship or institution that it called slavery. It didn't talk about conditions. So it looked at the legal definition of relationship, not at conditions. Why would it not look at conditions? Why would it look at a legal definition, in this case, the idea that someone is owned by another person? Why would it do that and not look at conditions? Because if you're an abolitionist, let's say, arguing with a Southern slave owner in the United States, and you start saying slavery is about someone being in bad conditions, work conditions, or living conditions, that Southern slave owner is just going to say, oh yeah, look at your factory workers. They look actually more miserable than my slaves. So you don't want to have that discussion. You want to open that door. So slavery is defined as a legal relationship. So what are the problem is, though? Sorry, the problem is that this one of the premises of the slavery conundrum, right, is that slavery is a gross and intrinsic evil across space and time. It's not about slavery's evil in our society. It's not about slavery's evil in the modern West or in Western Europe or in the Americas. It's slavery's evil throughout history, backwards and forwards in time, across the world, wherever you are. So the problem is, coming up with a definition for slavery that works in all those times and places, it's basically impossible. It's basically impossible. You end up with definitions that are so abstract. They're so abstract that they ultimately result in us projecting our own assumptions and understandings onto the past. What do I mean by that? Let's just look at three ways that have been used to define slavery. First, slavery is lack of freedom. Slavery is when someone is not free. Okay, here's the problem. We could say, let's say, in the United States, we could define freedom. We could maybe even define freedom in the West, but how do you define freedom throughout human history? What is it to be free? For in Roman law and in Western legal tradition, free means you can do whatever you want except what the law prohibits, right? Okay, but what's being a slave? Slave is you can do whatever you want except what your master prohibits. So freedom and slavery are not Freedom is not a complete lack of restraint or constraint. Freedom is just less constraint than a slave has. And exactly what constraints a free person has on them and exactly what constraints a slave has on them differ from time to time and place to place. And if you were to sit around and say, or you're going to make an argument that, well, a slave is always denied basic rights. What basic rights? Actually, you can't find a consistent notion of what the basic rights that slaves or non-slaves should have in human history. You could say, well, at the very least, let's say a slave you can just go and kill, and you can't do that to a free person. But that's actually not true. Most slave systems in world history, you could not just kill a slave, even their owner. And by the way, under Roman law, until the 2nd century AD, in theory, a father could kill his own child with no legal consequences. It's called patria potestas. So in Roman law, a father or the head of a family, the male head of a family, could kill anyone in his own family with no legal consequences, in theory. It didn't really happen, but in theory. So even the notion that, you know, the idea, oh, well, a slave is someone you can just do anything to and have no consequences, that doesn't help you in Roman law because that also describes a father of a free person or the status of a free child. You could say, well, let's define slavery as property, somebody being the property of another person. How do you define property? In the Western legal tradition, we can define property, it's usually like a bundle of rights, the right to use, the right to exclude, the right to sell, the right to destroy. But sometimes you have some of those rights and you own something. For example, you can't do whatever you want with your house and you own your house. You can't do whatever you want with your pets and you own your pets. You can't sit there and torture your pet. Right? It's against the law. But if you have let's say a Van Gogh painting and you just feel like being a jerk, you can destroy that Van Gogh painting. It's just yours. So property, what it means for owning different things is different, even in one society. Then try and come up with a definition for property across world history. You end up with something like this. Property is a person having some kind of rights over something. And then so slavery would be one person having some kind of rights over another person, which basically describes almost any relationship. Sometimes we talk about defining slavery as coercion, coercive power over somebody. Same problem. How do you define coercion? We could come up with a clear understanding in the United States about what was unacceptable coercion in a relationship. But then to say we can project this definition across world history, almost nobody in world history would be free if they lived up to like modern American labor standards for what is a coercive relationship. I just, on the airplane here, I watched part of Wonder Woman. It's research. Look, it's going into my talk. Okay. So there's a scene where Wonder Woman is like World War I. Do you guys see the movie? No, okay, they didn't watch Wonder Woman. So basically, she comes to England in World War I, and she's from some island that's stuck in ancient Greece history. And so she meets this woman who's a secretary of the guy. And she says, "What's a secretary?" And the woman says, "Well, whatever he says to do, I do, and wherever he says to go, I go." And Wonder Woman says, "Where I come from, we call that slavery." Right? So there's this kind of notion there that the idea is the filmmakers are saying that modern laborers or treatment of women in the workforce is kind of like slavery. This, as you can imagine from the example I just gave you, this gets very political. This gets very political even in, let's just say, the modern United States, let alone globally. So one example of this is in the 1790s in England and Scotland, there were these people working in Scotland in coal mines. And there was actually a debate about whether or not these people were slaves or not. In fact, they would sometimes wear collars with their master's name on them. These were white, like Scottish people. And the main argument for them not being slaves wasn't about how they were treated or whether or not they were born into slavery or not. It was the fact that people had decided there was no slavery in England. After the 1770s, there was no slavery in England. So it was like a it was basically a political statement about the nature of British society that defined whether these people were slaves or not, not how they were treated even. Another great example of this is this notion of modern-day slavery, which I'm sure you read about in the newspaper or in magazines, hear about on the news. So in 1957, there's a major convention called the 1926, there's a major convention for the outlawing of slavery globally. And in 1957, there's a supplementary convention. So the 1926 convention is about outlawing slavery. 1957 convention is about outlawing things that are like slavery, but not slavery. And one of those is what's called bonded labor. Bonded labor means I agree to work for you for a certain amount of time, and in return, you know, you pay for my trip to Dallas, Texas, and you pay for my housing, and I work for you for 10 years, and then after that, you know, maybe I can stay here, but we're done. So that's sometimes it's called indentured service or bonded labor, right? So in the 1957 convention, bonded labor is not slavery. It is servitude that is similar to slavery, but not slavery. According to the what's called the new slavery or modern day slavery, as it's been understood from the late 1990s until today, the major portion, one of the largest, if not the largest portion of global slavery today is bonded labor. So what you see is actually, it's like an inflation in the concept of slavery. What was not slavery in 1957 has become slavery today. Another example of this is prison labor. So in the late 1990s, some advocates for prisoners' rights in the United States started saying that prisoners in the United States are essentially slaves, because the 13th Amendment in the United States Constitution does not allow forced labor and slavery except for people who are in prison. Those people can be forced to work for essentially no pay. People didn't really accept this argument. But now, what do you see? Even scholars of new slavery and people who are major advocates of what's called new abolitionism. In 2006, they did not accept that prisoners in American prisons were slaves. Now those same people are saying, we're reconsidering it. What changed? Did the conditions of American prisoners change? No. Did the definition of slavery change? No. It's just a political circumstances changed. Things like Black Lives Matter, movies like documentaries like 13th. And now, again, yes or sorry, but this is research. Thor Ragnarok, who saw Thor Ragnarok? Okay, I shouldn't ask these questions at this mosque. Okay, none of you saw Thor Ragnarok, nor should you. I did it for research purposes. In Thor Ragnarok, there's this alien master of this planet who runs like this gladiatorial competition played by Jeff Goldblum. And he's sort of this very schmarmy politician, kind of corporate politician. And there's these gladiators are rebelling. And his minister comes up and says, "Sir, the slaves are revolting." And he says, "No, don't say that. Don't say that word." And they say, "What, revolting?" He says, "No, the S word. Don't say the S word." And then the person says, "Sorry, the prisoners with jobs are revolting." So then when you get Hollywood behind you, Hollywood behind the idea that American prisoners are actually slave laborers, you can see how much this has changed since the late 1990s, when saying American prisoners were slaves would just sort of fall on deaf ears and maybe even be considered unpatriotic. Okay, so you have this notion of, even in the last couple of decades, an inflation, like a devaluing of the moral power or the power of the word slave. Another example, by the way, is, I know this is in Texas, the idea that the Irish, that the white people who came to America were slaves because they were indentured servants. Isn't this taught in the Texas school curriculum? Someone told me this. Okay, I don't know about this, but someone told me this. I'll have to reevaluate this. But it was. So there's this, you see the idea that, like, my ancestors, some of them came to the U.S., to then the North American British colonies, as indentured servants. And so the argument of some kind of white nationalists is that, well, yeah, we had slavery in America, slavery of black people, but white people were also slaves because they were indentured servants. And to which a lot of African Americans would say, what the hell are you talking about? Those people chose to come, whereas my ancestor was just grabbed and sold, right? But here's the problem. By the modern definitions of new slavery, those white people were slaves. So when you start talking about projecting some of these definitions backwards in time, it starts to mess with how we conceptualize slavery in history, what we're willing to accept as slavery versus what we're not willing to accept. Okay. We end up with situations where we come up with definitions for slavery, but that definition ends up including something in history that we don't really think is slavery, versus other things that look a lot like slavery to us, but don't fit our definition. So we end up with definitions that don't really work. We're not able to put everything we want into the definition and exclude the things we don't want. So up here on the screen, you have two figures. On the right would be Malik Ambar. Malik Ambar died in 1626. He's an Ethiopian slave general who was brought to the Deccan city of Ahmednagar and was a senior general there, and then eventually became like the power behind the throne and the regent in that city. On the left-hand side, you have Sokulu Mehmed Pasha. He's sitting there presiding over a bunch of heads. Yes, those are heads of enemy soldiers. He was the Grand Vizier. He died in 1579, the Grand Vizier of three Ottoman sultans. His family made him a slave when he was 18 years old. He was a Serb from a Serbian Christian family, and they made him they gave him to the Sultan as a slave when he was 18 years old so that he could become a powerful member of the Ottoman administration, because the senior administration of the Ottoman Empire at this time and for another century after that were all slaves. He was the most powerful, except for the Sultan, the most powerful person in the Ottoman Empire for decades. The richest and most powerful. He was married to one of the Sultan's daughters, actually. And yet he was technically a slave. So are we really going to say that Sokolu Mehmed Pasha is an example of the same phenomenon as a field hand being lashed in the summer heat of South Carolina in the year 1750? Are we really going to say this is the same phenomenon? And if we say we can't make internal distinctions because all slavery is slavery, what is that? That really handicaps us morally. I mean, we end up making the same moral judgment for these two different situations that are so dramatically disparate from one another. And just so you know, this isn't just what you think you're going to get in trouble for saying at a barbecue. This is even true amongst academics. There's one of the leading scholars of slavery in American history. I was listening to a speech she gave, and she was talking about the conditions between slaves in the field versus slaves in urban areas in the American South. And someone asked her, so how do the conditions differ? And she was about to say something, and she stopped herself. And she said, I was about to say one is better than the other. But she says, basically, this is not appropriate. We don't like to talk about one thing being better than the other, because they don't want to introduce the concept of saying one kind of slavery is better than the other, because axiom number two is all slavery is slavery. You can't make internal distinctions. Okay, so this leads us to two major handicaps. One, we can't make different moral judgments about things that are very different. And two, the political nature of this means that slavery is usually what other people do. This has changed a little bit in the last couple of years because of increased American willingness to really turn a critical eye on, let's say, American prisons and American labor market. But you probably all recognize that this discussion about American prisoners being slaves, this wasn't very popular a few years ago. It's only kind of become popular, I think, as a result of Donald Trump and sort of a notion of a far left resistance to Donald Trump, which has really made palatable a lot of ideas that would not have been acceptable at all in mainstream American society 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Okay. That's the first issue about kind of thinking about the definition of slavery and the slavery conundrum. Why is it so hard to talk about? Because it ties our mind in knots. It makes us hold internally contradictory ideas. So let's talk about abolition and the origins of abolition. There's two narratives about this. The popular narrative, which is also, by the way, a major scholarly narrative, is what? You can call it the moral awakening narrative. So what happens? Some point in the distant past, there was a few voices who said, slavery is wrong. And those people went out and argued. And then more people agreed with that. And then more people agreed with that. And then more people agreed with that. And then in the 1700s, it sort of grew into a sort of snowballed to have real substance and real mass. And then in the 1800s, especially in places where humans had become enlightened by the Enlightenment, like Great Britain and the United States, northern United States, people realized slavery was a gross intrinsic evil and had to be ended. And then they eventually convinced everybody in the whole world. And that's how we get to the modern-day abolitionist consensus, which is that slavery is a transhistorical moral evil and it needs to be removed from the face of the earth. Right? That's the what we can call the moral awakening narrative. There's a couple problems with the moral awakening narrative. As I said before, there's no religion or philosophical tradition that condemns slavery qua slavery, that condemns slavery as slavery, until the very earliest of the 1600s. Aristotle, Plato, St. Augustine, the Buddha, Jesus, Moses, the Prophet Muhammad, St. Thomas Aquinas, I can just go through the history of humanity. There's nobody who said slavery is in and of itself a moral evil. They could criticize abuses of slavery. They could criticize the wrong people being enslaved. But there was no moral minority saying that slavery was evil. I've counted, and I've done a lot of research on this, I've counted one person, like, I don't mean one group of people, I mean one person, prior to the 1500s, who said slavery, qua slavery, was evil. It was a person named Gregory of Nyssa. He died in 394, the Common Era. He was from Cappadocia in Andalusia, and he was a church father there. He said philosophically and theologically, slavery is wrong. That's it. Until the late 1500s, there's a guy named Jean Baudin in France, died 1596. He says also slavery is wrong. It's evil. It harms the slave. It harms the master. And then in the late 1600s, you see it amongst American Quakers. There's when you see the real beginning of abolition, the idea that slavery as an institution needs to be gotten rid of. And then it really picks up in the 1700s and the 1800s. So if this is a moral awakening, it means that basically all of humanity was sound asleep out to lunch until the 1600s. The greatest minds, the most righteous and pious souls of every single religion and philosophical tradition didn't know that slavery was wrong. Or, what's worse, maybe they know and didn't say anything. When kuntum la ta'lam fu tilka musibatun when kuntum ta'lam fu musibatu a'zam. What's the, I forget which one it is. Yeah, so if you what's worse, that they didn't know or they did know and they knew and didn't say anything? The point is, does this mean that a person today who knows slavery is wrong is more morally intelligent than Plato or Aristotle or Jesus or Moses or the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam? I mean, forget about the theological problem that caused for Muslims. Just think about what that means about, I mean, why do we read any of their books? I mean, why do we have any respect? I mean, if we're going to take down Thomas Jefferson's statues, let's get rid of all this entire heritage. So that's the second problem with the moral awakening narrative, is what was brought up by especially historians from outside the First World, outside kind of the U.S. and Europe in the mid-20th century. And this is what was called the kind of economic narrative or economic explanation. Okay, so I told you before, it's really in the 1700s that abolitionism starts gaining a lot of momentum, and the 1800s. Does anyone know anything else that was happening in that time period? Industrial Revolution, right? So is it a coincidence? Is it a coincidence that people start to say that slavery is a moral evil in precisely those places, namely Great Britain and the Northern United States, precisely in those places where, one, the earliest stages of the Industrial Revolution take place, and two, where people achieved unprecedented wealth without reliance on slavery? Is that coincidence? Aristotle made a very prescient point. You guys know Aristotle, died 322 BC. Greek guy, lots of statues. He said, there will be slavery until looms spin themselves. You guys know what a loom is? Like a thing that weaves cloth. Until they move themselves, they'll be slaves. When did slavery become something that people talked about getting rid of? When human beings discovered that you can use water power and then fossil fuels to move things that used to be moved by animals and humans. That simply can't, I just simply can't accept that as a coincidence. Right? Here's the problem. Wait, you say, Professor Brown, you're telling me that abolition became a phenomenon with strength, that even became something of note at all because of technology and economics? But what I feel in my heart isn't technology and economics. What I feel in my heart is, like, when I hear the word slavery, or when I see a movie like 12 Years a Slave or Amistad, what I feel in my gut, you can't explain that by technology. You can't explain that by economics. That's moral revulsion. I feel moral revulsion in my gut. Correct? But here, there is great wisdom in the Islamic tradition of ethics and the Islamic tradition of moral epistemology. Muslim scholars, the vast majority, except for the Mu'tazila, we were talking about this earlier, right? This is why they were wrong, I think. The vast majority of Muslim scholars did not trust your gut. It reminds me of George Bush. Do people remember that now? You guys are a lot of old people in the crowd, so you remember George W. Bush. Remember he made decisions about his gut? Muslim scholars do not trust your guts. Why do they not trust guts? Why do they not trust someone feeling morally revolted? Because they were dealing with a world that spread from Egypt to Central Asia, from Southeast Asia to Senegal. And there's have you ever seen the movie? I don't know what to tell you. This is all research, people, okay? The movie The 13th Warrior with Antonio Banderas, it's about Muslims, people. Muslims are the Muslim is the hero of the movie.
So it's halal.
Yeah, and there's no hanky-panky. Yes. There's a lot of violence. No hanky-panky. So it's actually a real story, except for the part with the monsters. But until the part with the monsters, it's actually a real story of an Arab diplomat named Ahmed ibn Fadlan, who in the 900s gets sent by the Abbasid Caliph to the land of the Bulgars in Central Asia. And on the way, he meets a bunch of Vikings. And he witnesses a Viking funeral. This is in the book, and it's in the movie. And what's in the movie is accurate to what's in the book. He sees them. I can't describe what they do. It's so disgusting. Just watch the movie, okay? It's so disgusting, I can't describe it. How they clean themselves, I'm going to tell you. They all pass around a little bowl of water, and they all blow their nose into the same bowl and spit into it, and they pass around and they're drinking it. Okay, it's like the worst thing you can imagine. And then what they do to the body of the person they're burying and to the people involved is, I actually can't talk about. It's really disgusting. And Ibn Fadlan asks them, he says, how can you possibly do this? This is disgusting. And they say, what do you mean? This is totally normal. You guys are the disgusting ones. You take your dead bodies and you put them in the ground where the worms eat them? This is disgusting. How can you do this? So they understood that what grosses people out, what people think is morally disgusting, is really not, it's not a product of some way that your body or your mind is in tune with some kind of moral reality that transfuses in the world or that permeates the world. It's just custom. It's just urf. You guys know the concept of urf? It's just urf. And here's a good example today. If I brought, where are you from? Okay. If I brought you a plate of dog meat, like puppy meat with little puppy toes and ears, I said, here's your puppy, here's your dog meat, what would you do? No, I mean, I tell you, I'd feel sick to my, first of all, I'd feel this is morally wrong and I'd feel disgusted. Just imagine you're a random American. Random American would be outraged, morally outraged, and they'd be disgusted to the point of vomiting. In southern China, they have dog meat restaurants. Actual restaurants. Okay. The stuff that feels like it's wrong in your gut, that something has to be inherently morally wrong about this, for another person, to another person in the world today, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, it just wasn't a big deal. I don't want to ask you this question. This is really, I think, a very good point to keep in mind. If I asked you, if I told you that last week someone had been brutally murdered outside of this neighborhood, what would your reaction be? I mean, that's bad. Like, is that, if they catch the person who did it? Do I know the person who got killed? Let me ask you a question. I wanted to, how explicit I can be with this audience. Okay, if I told you that somebody married a 10-year-old girl, what would you say? A 50-year-old man.
We all know the example.
No, I'm just...
It doesn't work for us.
No, I mean, I feel disgusted by that. In my stomach. But guess what? Murder is wrong. Every society in human history considers murder to be wrong. Every society in human history considers murder to be wrong. Yet I told you someone was murdered, and yeah, it's bad, but I mean, okay. Until basically 100 years ago, slavery was completely normal in many parts of the world. Unremarkable, unobjectionable morally to many people in this world. And until the mid-20th century, getting married to teenage girls or younger was normal in the United States. And in fact, it's still normal in lots of parts of the world today. So the things we feel the most disgust about, I'd say in America, I'd say the things we feel the most disgust, moral disgust about are slavery and pedophilia. Those are the two things we feel the most moral disgust about. These are two things that were common and unremarkable in the recent past. And the thing that is universally prohibited throughout, universally wrong in all societies, namely murder, yeah, it's wrong, but we don't get disgusted by it. Because disgust is a cultural construct. Disgust is culturally conditioned. What disgusts somebody in one society, I'm not just talking physically, I'm talking morally. What disgusts someone in one society doesn't disgust someone in another society. Because disgust is a way that a culture, affects moral change. It's the way the culture affects moral change. So it's not surprising that on those issues where the change has been most dramatic, you find the most intense senses of disgust. Okay. For Muslim scholars talking about law and ethics, Usuli scholars, what God commands is right. What God forbids is wrong. Those things we can talk about being absolutely right and wrong, absolutely wrong. But for pretty much all other moral feelings we have, those are based on custom. Those are based on urf. Something is ma'ruf, or something is munkar. Slavery was ma'ruf, and now slavery is munkar. And someone, you could say, Professor Brown, are you telling me that our moral condemnation of slavery is just based on custom? Like the same thing that tells me what kind of wedding gifts to give somebody? How dare you belittle my moral objection to slavery? I'm not belittling at all. In fact, that objection belittles the concept of custom. It belittles the fact that human beings, for most of their moral transactions in the world and most of their moral actions in the world, their judgments are based on custom, not based on some kind of universal moral law. And in fact, it's a very unique feature of modern Western society that we assume that everything that we feel is right and we feel is wrong must be a universal. So when we decide that, let's say, it's proper for women to dress with their hair showing and wearing short-sleeved shirts, or for guys to wear, not to wear a hat or something like that, we just assume that this is the normal thing that everybody in the world should do. And that women or men who are not allowed to dress like this in other countries are being oppressed, because these are universals. If we decide that it's right for people to be able to engage in all sorts of relationships before marriage, just based on what they feel with no consequences, this must be universal, that everyone in the world should follow. And if they're not being allowed to follow wherever they live, then they're being oppressed. So we live in a society that takes custom and makes it into moral universals. Whereas Muslim scholars understood that custom is really important. It has real legal meaning for people. It has real moral meaning for people, but that you can't universalize it because it's not fair to do that to other cultures. So, for example, if we were to have Sharia courts in America, I'm not advocating Sharia creep, but if we were to have Sharia courts in America, and my wife were to go and say, my husband, he sits around, he doesn't do any work around the house, he doesn't take care of the kids, he just goes out and hangs out with his friends all the time, and I think he's a lousy husband and I want to get divorced from him. My guess is that Muslim scholar applying Islamic law in America would say, yes, your husband is not giving you your haq. Because in American urf, these are not the duties and rights and obligations of men and women to one another in marriage. The obligations of a husband, the obligations of a wife, the rights of the husband, the rights of the wife, in Islamic law, these are determined by custom. I mean, there's a few outlines or boundaries and pillars that are determined by the Quran and the Sunnah, but the details, this is determined by custom. And this is legally meaningful. People will get divorced on this. Have to pay mahar or not pay mahar. Okay. The last thing I want to talk about, two things. I can't believe I've actually gotten through what I talked about. I'm going to talk about two other issues. One is the change that the change in slavery that was brought by Islam, and the second is abolition of slavery in Islam. It is not exaggeration. It is not, and I will happily go in front of the most skeptical academic audience and say this. This is not me doing some kind of Muslim cheerleading, Islam is great, Muslims invented ice cream. I'm not doing that kind of thing. This is completely true. The Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet and the legal understanding of the early Muslim community completely revolutionized slavery in the Near East. And slavery in kind of what we would think of sort of the Western world, one of Central Asia or Mediterranean world, Europe, and then the Americans. The main routes into slavery, the main ways that someone became a slave prior to Islam in the Near East were debt. You owed money, you couldn't pay, you became the person's slave. Capture, as a basically being raided. Self-dedition, which means giving yourself as a slave. This is, people don't know this, but many, many millions of people in human history gave themselves as slaves to other people. Why would they do this? Because they were starving, because they were poor, because they were foreigners in a place where no one protect them. And being protected and taken care of was more important to them than their freedom. Selling your children into slavery. This is a major source of slaves in the ancient Near East, in India, until the 20th century, in Southeast Asia, in medieval Europe, was selling your children into slavery because you couldn't afford to keep them or because you owed money. Islam eliminated all of these. There is no debt slavery. And this is very clear in the Sharia. Every once in a while in Islamic history, you see it, for example, in Southeast Asia, in the 1500s and 1600s, you see some debt slavery. But this is a pre-Islamic tradition that continues. The Sharia prohibits debt slavery. The Sharia prohibits self-dedition. You cannot give yourself as a slave. The Sharia prohibits selling your children as slaves into slavery. So the major routes into slavery are all cut off completely. What's interesting is these are actually not mentioned in the Quran or in the Hadiths, but they're simply, it's just like understood by consensus in the early Muslim community, it's ended. There's only one way to become a slave in Islamic law, which is for a Muslim to capture a non-Muslim outside the abode of Islam in a war. That's the one way. Or you can be born into slavery if your mother is a slave woman. Another really important change that Islam brought for slavery was what happens to the offspring between a slave, male slave owner and his female slave. So remember I gave you the example of Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson's children were born slaves. They were born slaves, and they were born members of an oppressed class in the United States, which are African Americans. What's an African American? How do you define African American versus white in the United States? Anybody know? Skin tone? I mean, can you be like, let's say all of my ancestors are white except for one person, but I have, am I black or white? One drop means you're black. White means no blackness. Unless you're able to pass, which means no one can tell that you're black, you have black ancestry. But you can be extremely dark or you can be extremely light, but if you're black, you're black. And otherwise, you can't be part white. You're either white or you're fully white or you're black, right? If Thomas Jefferson had been a Muslim, his children would have been born free. They would have been born free. They would have been legitimate. They could inherit from him. Their mother would have been freed when their father died. And this is important. They would have had the same social standing as children born of a free wife. This is also agreed upon in Islamic law. Completely. Very important. The offspring of a male slave owner and his female slaves are born free, they're legitimate, and they have the same social standing as people born of free women, free wives. That's why almost all the Abbasid caliphs and all of the Ottoman sultans except one were children not of wives, not of free wives, but of slave women. This is what leads to What the scholar of African history, Ali Mazrui, rahimahullah, who died recently, called ascending miscegenation. Ascending miscegenation. Whereas in America, people who were result of mixed free and slave unions went down into the enslaved oppressed class. People who were resulted in, who were born of those unions in Islamic civilization went up into the free Muslim community. The final thing, the final change brought by Islamic law, or the Quran and the Sunnah, is an obsession with emancipation. Emancipation is different from abolition. Emancipation means freeing people. Abolition means getting rid of the institution of slavery as a whole. The Quran does not propose abolition. Why not? Because nobody proposed abolition until the early modern period. There's no society that had slaves, which is almost every society in human history, and certainly every civilization in human history. No one proposed the idea of abolition until the early modern period. I want you to understand this very clearly. Who saw the movie Spartacus? Come on, that's an old movie. That's okay, right? You guys didn't watch Spartacus? This guy watches everything. Someone needs to talk to him. So the Spartacus, if you see in the beginning of the movie, Kirk Douglas, he's like a slave. He says, he labored under the sun and the hot sun and the dreaming of a day when slavery would die 2,000 years before it ever would. And in the movie, Spartacus gives a speech where we're going to fight until we free all the slaves in the world, or all the slaves in the Roman Empire. That's not at all what Spartacus's rebellion was about. Spartacus wasn't fighting to end slavery. He and his friends, they just didn't want to be slaves. And in fact, they took their own slaves. And all pre-modern slave rebellions, they're not trying to end slavery. They're just trying to get out of their own situation, slavery. And they very often took their own slaves. So yes, abolition is not indigenous to Islam, in the sense that it's not present in the Quran and the Sunnah. But it's not indigenous to any religion or any philosophy. It's only something that emerges as an idea in the early modern period, really in the 1700s. What the Quran and the Sunnah do is they provide an impulse and an impetus for emancipation that does not have an equal in any religious or philosophical tradition that I've seen, pre-modern religious or philosophical tradition. The Quran introduces a few things that are unprecedented. One is it ties the charity tax, the zakat, to freeing slaves. One of the eight groups that can get zakat are slaves to help free themselves. Two, the idea of freeing slaves as expiation for certain sins or as partial punishments or as things you do to expiate sins or crimes. Three is the notion of making that notion of mukataba highly recommended or required. Mukataba is when a slave says, I want to basically buy my own freedom on installments. So the Quran says, if a slave wants to do this, if your slave wants to do this, then do it in alimtum fihim khayran. If they are able to do it, if you think they're going to be able to do it, then you should agree. And in the Muwatta of Malik, the Caliph Omar radiallahu ta'ala anhu actually makes Anas agree to a mukataba request from his slave. So these things are really unprecedented in history as far as I know. And the hadiths, the rewards you get for freeing slaves is incredible. The rewards in the afterlife. Now what's really interesting is not only are there lots of sahih hadiths about this, but Muslims crank out forgeries. If you look at books of forged hadiths, like Suyuti or Ibn al-Jawzi, you'll find the most outrageous hadiths that are doing what? Urging Muslims to free their slaves. One hadith that's made up in the 800s, I mean, I'm not saying it's made up. Muslim scholars said it's made up. Suyuti Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani said this. And if a Suyuti says it's made up, it's definitely made up. Because he's very lax in his standards, rahimahullah, right? So this one, it's supposedly the one of the last khutbahs given by the Prophet. He says, if you walk to the mosque, think about this. If you walk to the mosque, every step you take is the equivalent of freeing a slave. Now that's interesting. That hadith isn't telling you to free slaves, but freeing slaves has become so important that freeing slaves is like the unit of measurement you use to talk about the reward you're going to get for something else. Another hadith that's made up in the 900s, the Prophet allegedly says, he tells a woman, sabbihi, do tasbih of God, right? For every tasbih is the equivalent of freeing 100 slaves. So slavery, freeing slaves is such a basic unit in Muslim understanding of pious life that it becomes a way to count other good deeds. And this impetus to free slaves, this drive to emancipate, is so widespread and consistent that if you look in Islamic history, now Islamic history is very long and very broad geographically, but in general, this is a generalization, but I think it's a fairly accurate one. People who were slaves to Muslims were not slaves for their whole lives. They were usually slaves for like 7 to 10 years, and then they were freed. And if they became Muslim in that time, they entered the Muslim community as members in good standing, as citizens like anybody else. And by the way, this is another argument for why there was not an indigenous movement for abolition in the Islamic world like there was in the Americas, especially the Caribbean, in the 1700s and 1800s. Why? First of all, the majority of slaves brought into Islamic civilization were women, who then were made part of families and who had children with those families. So they were integrated into those communities. The second reason is if you were a freed slave in the Caribbean or in the United States, you're still a black person. You could still be re-enslaved, like in the movie 12 Years a Slave. You're still treated like garbage. And worse, you weren't an enfranchised member of society. So the only way, as long as slavery existed, you were under threat of re-enslavement. The only way to get rid of, to ever feel safe, was to end slavery or to do what's called maroonage, which means you basically go and you live in some isolated part of an island with other escaped or freed slaves. For Muslims who were freed slaves, they were part of the society. They could be successful merchants. They could be Muslim scholars. They could be saints. In my book, there's a whole section on slave saints, by the way. Saints who are slaves. Awliya. The way that we can talk about abolition in the Islamic tradition that I think is the most accurate is to say that, and this is entirely authentic in the Sharia tradition, that as a legal maxim says, يَتَشَوَّفُ الشَّارِعُ إِلَى الْحُرِيَّةِ, the lawgiver, God, looks expectantly towards freedom. And actually, you can find this in one of the earliest books that survives in Islamic tradition, the Kitab al-Tahrish of Dirar ibn Amr. There's a hadith. We talked about this hadith, actually. It comes from the very early period. We don't know if the Prophet said it or not, but it's a very early idea. If a man says to his wife, أنت طالق إن شاء الله, she's not divorced, because God doesn't want divorce. But if you say to your slave, "Antahur insha'Allah," the slave is freed. Why? Because God wants freedom. So even if you look in the Kitab al-Muwafaqat of Ash-Shatibi, died 1388, a major scholar of the Maqasid of the Sharia, he says one of the Maqasid of the Sharia is al-itq, freeing slaves. And if we now live in a time when it's economically, not just economically feasible, but economically profitable not to have slaves, if we can remove the harm of slavery, and this is something I forgot to mention, which I'll shoehorn in really quickly. Muslim scholars always recognized that slavery was harmful. They talked about darar ar-riq, the harm of slavery. What was the harm of slavery? They realized that being a slave was not pleasant for a lot of people. You were unable to make your free choices. You were, you couldn't, let's say, lead prayer or lead a Jummah prayer. You were unable to benefit from the fruits of your own labor if you wanted. So that's why they understood that freeing people was a good thing. That's why there's fadl in itq. You get a reward for freeing people. But they also understood that it wasn't the most, they believed it was not the most important thing. So if someone was too old or too sick or too incompetent to handle themselves, it was actually wrong to free them, because they were going to be worse off if they were freed. So if we are in a position in world history where slavery is not needed economically, if we're in a position where we can remove the harm of itq from people, then the best way to fulfill this maqsid, this aim of the Sharia, of emancipation, is simply to do a categorical emancipation and get rid of the institution as a whole. Jazakum Allahu khair, and I can't believe I actually finished this, and I'll try and answer your questions afterwards, inshallah.
Jazakum Allahu khair. After Salat al-Isha, we will have around 15-20 minutes for Q&A, and I've already gotten a number of questions, but feel free to continue to send them in. Can you figure out how to send them in with the written paper? I know the number of people have asked, they're interested in Dr. Brown's personal story as well, of how he came from converting to Islam to becoming, without praising him too much, but the fact of the matter is, he is one of the most famous professors of Islamic studies in the world today. This is a very honorable, he's in Georgetown's, Islamic studies professor, and it's definitely a very interesting story from where to where. So a little bit about that as well after Salat al-Isha. But we have 5 minutes, so I'm going to ask you one question before Salat al-Isha. And that is, you glossed over this issue of concubinage. And obviously this is a very sensitive issue. So in 4.5 minutes, if you're able to answer, how do we explain to especially our young men and women, and the outside the faith is obviously different, but our young men, how do we rationalize the concept of milk yameen? Because there is consummation, and what if she doesn't want it? What if? I mean, how do we, so what do you say, what are your thoughts about this from within the paradigm?
Okay. I never do this, but I'm going to not answer the question. I mean, there's a whole chapter in it in my book, and that issue you don't talk about without, serious mental preparation. I mean, what I mean is that in the book I was able to, I think, do a very good and thorough job of discussing it. What I will talk about is one aspect, which is that, and this also comes up in, people talk about the notion of like marital rape in Islam and how there's no consent for, legally there's no notion of consent and for sex within marriage and things like that. And I think this is an instance where we have to understand how other legal traditions work and not just get obsessed with the language and concepts that we use in American law, especially modern American law and modern American society. So we in modern United States think about consent as the sort of sine qua non of morally acceptable relationship, right? So consent is what makes something okay. The lack of consent makes it not okay. It makes it not okay morally. It makes it not okay legally. This is fairly unusual in world history, especially the fact that this is basically the only moral tool we use in American society. Consent is of some importance in most legal and moral systems, but it's usually not the only thing. For example, if somebody wants to be in a relationship which is horribly destructive for them and their family doesn't like it, in a lot of places in the world, what they want doesn't really matter. The family's going to say, no, you can't be in this relationship, right? So that, the kind of, we don't have that in modern American culture. We don't accept that, right? It's the person's consent, their desire that makes something right or wrong. So I think the first thing to understand is that we make the concept of consent do a lot of moral and legal work that it's really not up for. And if you're interested in this, I can suggest an excellent book by Joseph Fischel, professor from Yale, and it's called Screw Consent. That's what the book's called. It's a very interesting excellent book of, you know, political theory and philosophy. I recommend the book. It's not very long. Now, consent is important in Islamic law. A woman who is baligh, right, she cannot be married off in general without her consent, right? But it's not, everybody doesn't have the same kind of power to consent. Your kind of consent is sort of based on the amount of importance of that consent is based on your social standing. But the reason why this sort of differed and had a sliding scale is because consent wasn't really how Muslim jurists and ethicists understood right and wrong in relationships. They understood it through the language of harm, darar, right? So if you're a wife and you go to and I have actually collected cases, and they're in my book, cases where women go to a judge and say, I can't get into the details, but it's, let's just say it's a good read. You'll enjoy it. You won't put it down, at least not for that section, okay? They go to judge and they say, certain things are happening and it's causing me harm. And the judge, the husband has a right to do those things. In theory, the woman, because she's married to him, has no capacity to consent. But the judge says, you can't do this anymore. Because the harm is what makes something right or wrong. So what the work that we do in modern America through the concept of consent, Muslim ethics and Muslim law did through the concept of harm. And you could not harm your slave. I mean, you could discipline your slave in the same way that you could discipline your child, but you couldn't, if you were to go and beat your slave severely in a way that left like marks or made a lot of blood flow, then we have instances in the time of the Prophet, alayhi salam, and in Islamic history, throughout Islamic history, that the judge would force you to free the slave or to sell a slave. Right.
Inshallah, we will continue after Salat al-Isha, inshallah ta'ala, so please take for that. Jazakumullah khair.
Bismillah, alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salam rasulillah.
Why don't you take this one?
I see.
So the first question is that we have been told that some of our Muslim or Arab brothers were involved in the American slave trade. Is this correct in your research? And is this valid Islamically? And did they justify it, what they were doing, the Arab slave traders?
Okay, yeah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So, I'm not a specialist in the Atlantic slave trade, but I can, from what I do know, people buying, buying and selling at both ends, so to speak, right? So, most of the slaves who are, I don't want to say most, because I don't know if that's accurate or not, but I'll say a large portion of the slaves who are transported from West Africa to the Americas. Remember, most of the slaves went to Brazil. There's actually a really good graphic you can see on this for, I think, from like the African American History Museum, or I think one of the slavery databases. They actually have like a chart of all the ships, and you can see the majority of them actually go to Brazil. So they're basically being supplied by people who are raiding for slaves in interior in, you know, various parts of West Africa. And those people were, some of them are Muslim, some of them are not Muslim. But what's interesting is that, and if you want to read about this, you can read Bilal or Rudolf Ware, he's a Muslim, the name is Bilal, his book, The Walking Quran, he talks a lot about this, that in the late 1700s and the early 1800s, there's a state that's created in what's now essentially Senegambia, a place called Futatora, which arises because these two ulama, see Muslims being enslaved and they can't accept that. So they basically start a kind of a political movement, military political movement, and create a state in order to make sure that no Muslims are sold into slavery to the Europeans. And they, in fact, strike treaties with the French that no French slave ships are going to come up the Senegal River. And eventually the Europeans like basically give support to other states and they defeat this state, but the Imamate of Fututora. The other thing is that I know at least one scholar in West Africa, I think one of the scholars from the lineage of Mukhtar al-Kinti, a great kind of West African scholarly tradition, he prohibited selling any slave if you thought that that slave might get sold to a European. So I don't know about, yes, Muslims were involved for sure, but there was also a lot of Muslims, especially Muslim scholars, who were really committed to preventing any Muslims being sold into that transatlantic slave commerce or whatever, slave trade.
So we have another question here. I'm going to combine two questions. You said, do not trust your gut. How do we understand this in the light of the fitra and also in light of the hadith, al-birru matma'anta ilayhi al-nafs wal-ithmu ma'haka fi sadrika wa-law aftak al-nas wa-aftawk. Both of these things do have a gut. So how do we say, trust your gut versus this?
Someone like, you know, rahimahullah Ibn Taymiyyah would talk about the notion of al-aql al-salim, you know, or like so it's not that human beings can't have a kind of correct moral sense, but that we need to be very aware that we need to be able to kind of read our moral senses through an awareness of our culture, right? So let's say, you know, I'm American. If someone says something about democracy, I'm going to be like, democracy. If someone says something about tyranny or monarchy, I'm going to say tyranny, monarchy, right? So we kind of have this, we're acculturated into a view that democracy is good, tyranny slash monarchy is bad. So you just have to be aware, I think, of how what your biases are. If you know that you have a temper, if you know that you have an ego, if you know that you have a hard time letting go of money or things like that, you know, I think you have to be aware of what your own failings are, what your own biases are, and then you can, it's at that point, like your sense of your kind of moral intuition becomes more toned, more tuned, more finely tuned. So I don't mean to say that, you know, your gut is useless. I just mean to say that you need to always be aware that your gut is also a creation of your circumstances.
Do you mind if I add to that? It's awkward
you can add as much as you want.
As you're probably aware, the third chapter of my dissertation is about the fitra, the concept of the fitra, Ibn Taymiyyah. So just to add to that, Ibn Taymiyyah mentions that the fitra can be corrupted. And when the fitra is corrupted, then you will feel the incorrect fitra telling you something that is incorrect. So hence this notion of gut instinct is not necessarily right or wrong. So the point is, as Ibn Taymiyyah mentions, the fitra needs a check and balance mechanism. Who's going to check which fitra is valid or not? So he gave the example of eating something that one culture finds disgusting versus another culture finds not disgusting. The culture that doesn't find it disgusting, the culture that has taken it as the norm, how will they know that it is wrong? Because their gut instinct is going to say that it's fine. So even the fitra, it needs a checks and balances. It needs a higher source to tell it. Once the fitra is in line with the higher source, now the gut instinct does kick in, right? So if you have iman and taqwa, then yes, you follow your gut instinct. But if you don't really have iman and taqwa, or you don't have, your fitra is not in sync with the Quran and Sunnah, it's been corrupted, then you cannot rely just on your fitra for morality. So that was,
add to that, inshallah. Okay. We have an expert on the subject with us.
We have a question here. Is warfare the only basis for enslavement? Is the only way to get a slave is
the war? So I should have mentioned this. I meant to and I forgot. Which is so probably, and it's hard to know because Islamic civilization is very big over a long period of time, but probably most of the slaves who come into Islamic civilization are not captured in warfare. They're bought. So you go to the slave market in Samarkand or Gench, and there's like a Viking guy there who's got like 300 Russian peasants, and he says, like, here's 300 Russian peasant slaves for you. So that's like the majority are just purchased from outside. So if someone's already a slave, you can purchase them. So that's probably how most people entered Islamic civilization, especially from the Central Asia, Russian area, which is, by the way, probably the majority of slaves in Islamic civilization are from that area. The issue comes with whether the warfare that allows enslavement is like sanctioned by the imam versus just raiding. Because a lot of it is just raiding. And there's actually ikhtilaf amongst the ulama about whether that's allowed or not. And what happens in the 19th century, when a lot of this is interesting. Like, we would expect that kind of slave trade in the Muslim world, especially like Africa and Indian Ocean world, is like kind of decreasing, and then it gets rid of it. That's actually not the case. Its peak in terms of numbers is in the 1800s and 1900s. Like in the early 20th century, the Red Sea is just teeming with slave trade. So probably more so than earlier. So a lot of Muslim scholars start getting really concerned about the slave trade in the late 19th century and the early 20th century for two reasons. One, because a lot of Muslims are being enslaved. People going to Hajj from Balochistan or from Southeast Asia or West Africa were being enslaved. Like Al-Kalbani, you know Imam Al-Kalbani? Mm. His family, his ancestors, were Muslim scholars who were going to Hajj and were enslaved.
I didn't know that.
You can't enslave Muslims. This is unacceptable, right? This is completely unacceptable in the Sharia. So one of the things that they start to talk about, like Muhammad Bayram al-Khamis, who dies in 1889, Abdurrahman al-Kawakibi dies in 1902, then Muhammad Abdul Rashid Ridha, the stuff they talk about is actually, they're saying that a lot of these, the raiding has become unacceptable. Like these, they kind of take the position that only a sanctioned warfare by the imam can create prisoners that you can enslave, and you can't just go raiding into the Sahara because a lot of times they're enslaving Muslims.
So can I ask a very blunt question? Is it true to say that, especially towards later Islamic times, most Muslim societies did not live up to the Islamic norms of slavery in terms of acquiring?
That's hard to say. I don't know. I don't know if it'd be hard to make that generalization. I'd say that there's certainly, by the late 19th century, it's certainly become a big enough problem that it was like spoiling a system, right? I mean, it was enough. It was problematic enough that when people like Muhammad Bayram al-Khamis or Ahmed Bey, the governor of Tunis in 1846, when they said that there's too many people being acquired illegally that we basically have to end slavery, I don't think they were making that up. I think that was like a genuine concern of theirs. It became a genuine concern.
Okay. We have a question here that you talked about the fact that Islam is very encouraging to free slaves. What do we say to the argument that since Islam is universal and since the Prophet is the seal of prophets and since Islam came with so many other difficult things, why didn't Islam abolish instead of merely encourage? Why didn't it do that?
I mean, that's an excellent question. The answer is that it would be like, I mean, essentially it would be like saying we're going to abolish, you know, transportation. I mean, it wouldn't, or we're going to abolish working or walking. It wouldn't make sense for people. And I want to repeat this. Nobody thought it. Abolition wasn't some kind of idea that a few enlightened souls were arguing for. Nobody was arguing for that. No one conceptualized the idea of abolition. Even slaves who were engaged in slave rebellions like Spartacus weren't thinking about abolishing slavery, even in their own area, let alone like globally. It would be like, just imagine a world where in order to move anything, you need a person or an animal to do that. And then just imagine saying you can no longer use people or animals to move things. I mean, it just wouldn't make sense to people. So imagine the impact that use of fossil fuels has had on the human race. What kind of things that we are able to do with ease today? Like, we live lives where the weather means nothing. I mean, We live lives where I can literally go to London and come back in the same day. You know, I mean, this kind of thing is inconceivable to pre-modern minds. So if the Quran talked about abolition, it would be like us talking about, I don't even know, like dimensional transport or something. I guess we do talk about that. But like, you know, it would be like talking about like interdimensional transport in like 1800. It wouldn't make any sense.
So you also mentioned the issue that an argument can be made that Islam does discourage and encourages, let's say, abolishment. However, is it possible to theoretically claim, open-ended question he's saying, that if the circumstances change, slavery might return, and in the context of Islam, would then that be permissible?
Okay. So it's interesting you note this, because Sheikh Muhammad Sayyid Ramadan al-Buti, rahimahullah, right? He, in him, one of his books, he actually talks about this. He says that the concept of slavery is actually proof of Islam's universality. Why does he say that? He says that there may come a time when the laws of slavery will actually be needed again. And I don't think that's because he's arguing for the kind of Muslims reintroducing slavery like ISIS or something like that. It's because I want you to imagine, I call it the Mad Max Afterscape situation. You guys watch Mad Max movies?
No, of course not.
I can't communicate with you people. I know you people watch Mad Max movie. You know Mel Gibson and then
silence.
Tom.
I like this okay. Silence.
So imagine like, you know, nuclear war. We're all wearing rubber tire body armor with crossbows, driving around. We're all going to be like, you and me, Yasser, maybe we'll be like partners in this afterscape. We'll be like, hey, remember Yasser, we used to talk about human rights and that stuff. Ah, that was so funny, Robert. You know? So the point is, imagine a world where we actually don't have fossil fuels, don't have any kind of way to move things except people or human beings. If I were a betting man, I would argue that there's actually slavery will be reintroduced because it will be considered an economic. It would just be a result of economic course of events. Mm. And at that point, you know, human beings either are going to have rules for governing that or not have rules. So, again, I want to make very clear, because I don't want people to get the wrong idea, I'm not encouraging this. I'm not saying that I think it's a good idea. I'm not saying that Islam would think it's a good idea. Again, God wants freedom. God doesn't want slavery. So Muslims should always be on the side of emancipation. But I don't think by any stretch of the imagination it's inconceivable to think that there will be a time in human history that we will again have things that we consider slavery-like in the pre-modern period.
Inshallah, let's finish off with two, three questions, inshallah. I'm actually going to combine the next few in one. And again, I know you were hesitant to answer, and I fully understand, but I'm being bombarded, and especially there's a number of sisters are asking this, obviously. They are, obviously, fully understandably. One sister says that, as I understand it, masters were not even allowed to slap their slaves. So how can we understand the fact that a Muslim male slave owner is forcing himself on a slave girl? And another sister says that if emancipation was seen as such a good deed, then why did it take so long, or why were captured women kept slaves for so long merely to have a family, let's say?
So I think it's important to here to distinguish between law and application, social application of law. What do I mean by that? If you read, like, Ibn Hazm's, you guys know Ibn Hazm died 1056, right? Famous Zahiri scholar, 1064. So his book, Tawq al-Hamama, it's translated to English as Ring of the Dove. It's a treatise on love. And he, several instances, he talks about men who owned female slaves and who were like deeply in love with those slaves, but the slave didn't like them back. And it just drove those guys crazy. Ibn Hazm himself talks about, by the way, his first love, who he didn't get over for decades, was a slave woman who was deeply in love with her. And he has about a paragraph talking, praising her. So what I mean, and it's not just Ibn Hazm, but you can see another scholar who's writing in the 19th century in Mecca talks about the idea that he has a friend who's like madly in love with his slave woman, his own slave woman, and who is like crying because she's not interested in him. So I think it's important to remember that just because, and Ibn Hazm even says this, he says, these men, these women were their property. They could do what they wanted with them, but they're lovesick and they're heartbroken because they're not interested in them. So, I don't think that Muslim men were just... I don't think that Muslim men, just because they were legally allowed to do something, that necessarily followed that that's what they wanted to do all the time. And as I said before, it's very important to keep in mind that the work that in our legal and moral system we do through the concept of consent, Muslim scholars and Muslim ethics did through the concept of harm. Right? So if a slave woman was harmed by her owner's approaches to her or her owner's access of her, that was something that she could go to a judge and complain about and get relief from and get potentially maybe freed because of. And we have instances of this. This is not like a theoretical thing. We have like fatwas about this. We have court cases about this.
Final question, and then I have your personal question as well. So final question related to the topic, and then a question about your life. Question related to the topic. How do you address the fact that many pre-classical scholars of Islam thought of marriage as a form of slavery?
I don't think they thought of marriage as a form of slavery. I think they used slavery as an idiom for talking about marriage. Marriage is definitely not a form of slavery because wives are not slaves. They're not slaves. That's like a base. You cannot marry your slave in Sharia. You can free them and then you can marry them, but you can't marry your slave. So, when we talk about marriage in the modern United States, what do we say? We say it's a partnership. We say it's you're a team. I don't know, things like what other things that we talk about, right? You say it's a partnership, like a business partnership. I mean, think about the fact that we societies can have different idioms for legally talking about a relationship. And just because you choose that legal idiom doesn't mean that that is the nature of the relationship for those people involved. So Muslim scholars use the concept of milk, of property, when they're talking about marriage, but it doesn't mean that marriage was like equivalent of slavery or some modified version of slavery or something. So I think it's important to not get kind of legal language and legal idioms mixed up with the actual definition of these things in Islamic law or how they were understood.
Okay, and here's the question that a lot of people have been asking me to ask you. Can you tell us a little bit about your own conversion and your journey through Islam for the 7,627th second time?
This is online in a multiple.
We don't watch.
Forum.
We don't watch online. We don't watch videos, do we?
You guys are killing me. Someone actually wants to know this.
Do you guys want to know why he converted to Islam and his story?
Yes.
Okay, fine. I need to get a card I can just hand people. So, yes, I was. Long time ago, I was raised in Washington, D.C. suburbs. You guys know Brett Kavanaugh? Yeah, I'm from the same neighborhood as Brett Kavanaugh. But I'm not.
We all know Brett Kavanaugh.
No, but he's.
We don't know Mel Gibson.
He gave my neighborhood a bad name, Chevy Chase, Maryland. But that's where I'm from, suburb of outside of Washington, D.C. Total population of non-white people, zero. Except for some like Africans who work for the World Bank or something, but there's like no. It's a super
rich white person place. So that's where I grew up, and I was raised Christian. I was raised Episcopalian Christian, which is like American Anglican church. But I went to church every Sunday. We had to go to church every Sunday, and I was an acolyte. I went all the way through finished the senior level of acolyte. Those are the guys who help with the minister. They help the communion. They carry the cross and wear the outfits. Like, you see those English boys with those white outfits and the red and the black? That's what I used to wear on Sundays. That's also how I learned, by the way, that I was definitely going to be an alcoholic, because when they brought around the communion wine, like, you would get it first as the acolytes, and I would chug as much as I could. I loved it, even as a child. So I would be if I were not Muslim, I think I'd be a functional alcoholic. That's my theory. Alhamdulillah. So, but it was interesting because we didn't talk about... We went to church, but religion had no place in our household. So we didn't... No one ever talked about God or anything in my house. So it was really weird. I'm the most religious person by far in my family. But anyway, the point is that I didn't have like a lot of religion. Christianity wasn't really a big deal for us. So then I went to high school. I went to boarding school in California. I went to boarding school in the same town Sheikh Hamza Yusuf went to boarding school in, which is called Ojai, California, which no one knows about. But we went to rival high schools. Plus, he's older than me. And his dad, by the way, was a teacher at the boarding school that my dad was a student at. So my dad might have studied with his dad. But my dad died, so I couldn't ask him that question. So then I went to high school in California, and I had a lot of existential angst as a teenager. This might be normal. I had a lot of existential angst. Like, it was almost incapacitating for me. Then when I went to Georgetown for college, they have... you have to take two theology requirements. You have to take either Problem of God, which I didn't take, or you take Intro to Biblical Literature. I took Intro to Biblical Literature, and I was like, this is really interesting, but I don't think I want to follow this. And then the next class I took was randomly on Islam. And because I had this friend in my dorm who was actually a Palestinian guy, I had no idea about Islam. And one time I asked him, I was like, hey, how much does a camel cost? Like, I asked that non-ironically, like, not as a joke. I actually wanted to know. And he was like, two women. And then I was like, what? And he's like, no, I'm just messing with you. I don't know. I've never seen a camel in my life. But the point, he lived in the UAE. The point is, I had zero idea about Islam. But I was like, oh, it's interesting. I'll take this class on Islam to fulfill my second requirement. And you know who taught is the niece of Ismail al-Faruqi, rahimahullah, Maysim al-Faruqi. She taught the class, and we read Muhammad Asad's book. We read his translation of the Quran, and we read The Road to Mecca.
Yeah.
And The Road to Mecca really, like, bowled me over.
Amazing.
And I think kind of by the end of that semester, it was spring semester of my freshman year, I was really, like, I just really felt like a Muslim. And that summer I spent thinking a lot about the issue and stopped eating pork and stopped drinking and things like that. And then in the fall, when I went back to my second year, I went to the MSA Eid dinner at the beginning of the year, and I told someone I'm interested in becoming Muslim, and that was it.
Alhamdulillah. I'd like to obviously thank Dr. Danish Lavran. He is an extremely busy person. You didn't never told the story of the book. I'll just quickly mention it. Small controversy happened when he's giving a lecture. Small, very small controversy that took over the national media for a short period of time, where he basically told a Muslim in the audience, like, are you a Muslim? The guy said, yes. And he said, if you're a Muslim, how can you, dismiss slavery as being immoral when the Prophet ﷺ himself had a milk yameen? I mean, it's a contradiction. You either this or that. And he said this in an audience of non-Muslims as well.
No, there were no, it was all Muslims.
Oh, it was all Muslims. But then it got picked up by the non-Muslim media.
That person is actually a total idiot. But, I mean, I'm sorry, he's just a moron. And he then got all upset about this. And actually, the funny thing is he's actually a white guy. That's the funny. He's like a middle-aged white guy who got up. Anyway, he was really up. And then did you guys remember Milo?
Yes.
You remember Milo? I was Milo's last victim. Milo attacked me, and then Milo went down.
SubhanAllah.
You just remember this.
So when Dr. Brown was basically put under the spotlight, how do you respond when you're a professor at Georgetown? You write a 350-page book. So he dropped all of his other projects, and within 2 days, was it, or 4 days? I don't know, I'm just exaggerating. But subhanAllah, amazing fast turnaround. He publishes a book. Where's the book? It's over there. So I have the book, and I encourage all of you to get it. And it's a very readable book. It's not something that's only meant for PhDs in the ivory towers. It's meant for the inquisitive mind. That's the great thing about the book. It's actually meant for people that are struggling with these issues. And it's very, very readable. It's something that you will enjoy. I'm currently almost finishing it. Well, I haven't quite finished it yet. It's a very enjoyable book. So I do encourage you to purchase the book. And it's something that, inshallah, will be of great benefit. I'd like to thank Dr. Brown for spending so much of his time, precious time. He's on his other project now. He keeps on coming out with books and articles and puts all the rest of us to shame. I don't know how he does that, subhanAllah.
No friends.
And mashallah, also his family is very supportive. His wife's won 2 Emmys or 3, I forgot. His wife has won 2 Emmy Awards, mashallah, tabarakallah. So just a bit of pressure on him to also, you know.
Not as an actress, as a producer, as a journalist, just to be clear.
Okay, 2 Emmy Awards as a producer and journalist. So just a small bit of pressure on him to write another 15, 20 books to make up for that. But alhamdulillah, I would like to thank him immensely for coming down. He literally just came down for this talk. He's flying back early tomorrow morning. He just came down in the afternoon today. So jazakumullah khair. I hope that inshallah you also benefited and enjoyed your stay here. And inshallah, we do plan to invite him again for more difficult topics that only somebody in his position and tenure track and or tenured professor can say. The rest of us cannot say so. Jazakumullah khair. May Allah Azza wa Jal continue to bless you and guide you and guide others through you. And we ask Allah Azza wa Jal to cause you and all of us to be instruments of izzah to Islam and through Islam through what you are doing. You are one of the very, very few people I know, and I'm sorry to praise you in front of your face, but our audience should know, a practicing proud Muslim in the halls of academia is very, 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 very rare. Somebody who is unabashedly Muslim, somebody who defends Islam and the values of Islam at a place, you know, like Georgetown. I mean, it's something that, subhanAllah, almost unheard of, one of the very few people. So we thank Allah that we have somebody like Dr. Brown, and we ask Allah to continue to give him thabat and to make him firm and to make him a source of izzah for Islam and through Islam. Jazakumullah khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
لا يزال الخير حيا لا يزال إن في الدنيا سلاما وظلال أخبر الأيام أنا في وصال قم بنا وانظر لآيات الجمال قم بنا وانظر لآيات الجمال